going to keep going.
That's what I'm afraid of.
It's all right. We can edit this part out.
No worries.
Okay, you're adding. I'll wait to a quick string. Somebody from Cincinnati, Ohio.
It's all right.
Bringing to you the best stories from icons in the bourbon industry, it's Bourbon Pursuit. Now here are your hosts, Ryan and Kenny.
Hey guys, Ryan here. This is part two episode with Jim Rutledge from Four Roses. If you haven't listened to episode one, you might want to do that first, unless you like to listen to your episodes like a jigsaw puzzle. But here you go. Enjoy.
So, I mean, the bourbon market, you know, those numbers sound huge. They are huge. But remember, we're just now back in the U.S., and we're starting from this small base. Now, these huge numbers might be a very small percentage with the giants in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But that just means that we have that much further to grow. It's that many more opportunities. And it's going to keep on.
Yeah.
And
I guess so. What are you most excited for in the future of what's going to happen with Four Roses with this bourbon boom that is happening?
Well, we're going to have to get through a tight stretch. 2 or 3 years from now, we're going to get we're going to be very pretty tight.
Inventory-wise, yeah.
And but we are. I mean, here we were part of Sigrun. The biggest majority of what we produced at this distillery, some of our bourbon was shipped into Canada for. Because of the smoothness and mellowness of the bourbon we produce here, became flavoring components for brands like Crown Royal, Seagram VO, and some other blended whiskeys, even in Seagram 7. We had the Four Roses bourbon market in Europe and Japan, but the majority of what we were doing was blended whiskeys. So we've taken all this, what we were doing for Four Roses bourbon, and then what we were, how... When you're talking about a small percentage in Seagram 7, when they're doing 4 or 5 million cases a year, we were down to by then, that's a lot of flavoring,
mm-hmm.
a lot of gallons. And so all that's gone away, of course. And now we're to the point where we will need to almost double the capacity of our distillery.
Right. So, I mean, are there
it's
plans?
It's exciting. We're working on that.
Right.
And we're going to have to build a new bottling facility. We're going to have to build warehouses down the road, distillery operations. These are all in the planning stages now. Nothing's been cast in stone.
Because these aren't cheap things to do either, right. as
no,
most
that's
people understand.
It takes some time.
Yeah.
It takes some time. You want to make the decisions right and not make any mistakes in doing these things. So
it's got to be hard forecasting 8-10 years down the road. So it's like...
Oh, it's... you know, I wish... I was doing this for all the... when I was doing the distillery planning in New York, I was doing it for all the distillery, for all, whether it be one of 50 or 60 Seagram blended whiskeys, all the bourbons they had, the straight rye they had, anything with whiskey or gin or vodka, I was doing the planning for all of it. And gin and vodka is easy because you can distill it today and bottle it tomorrow, but anything that goes in a barrel, light whiskey as a flavoring component for a blended whiskey, had to be aged a minimum of 4 years. That's by law.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bourbons, the rye, corn whiskeys, barley bourbons, all these components made at all the distilleries, long-range planning. And it's a challenge. And it's, you know, whose crystal ball is better than the next person's? And you got to base it on experience. Of course, you know, people in marketing are very optimistic.
Right.
People in production are conservative. So, and I was trying to balance the two, and that's what we still sort of do the same thing right now. Whose crystal ball is best?
Right.
And if you make a mistake, you can either have a facility that's twice what you need, or half of what you need, or you know,
or you guess
have,
right,
or your existing
you gotta
facility.
Roll the dice.
That's right. So, but I think this. The growth we've experienced in the last few years, and we've got so far to go. It's going to be sustained for so long. We talk now, and you hear people talking about we have more barrels of bourbon in Kentucky than we have people. Somewhere around, and I don't know exactly what it is.
I've also heard that we have more barrels aging than we have people and horses combined. So no, I've heard a lot.
No, I don't think so. I've seen a lot of horses around, and it could be maybe thoroughbred horses.
Maybe
it could be, but don't we? I think the population somewhere around 4.3 million, some plus or minus, and we have over 5 million barrels in inventory right now. So 700,000 plus or minus horses. I don't know how many horses. That's a pretty big herd of horses.
We'll ballpark something.
But if you go back, and 40% of that now, see, it's not only growth in the U.S., 40% of those barrels are designated for international markets. So 3 million are designated for use in the U.S. to satisfy U.S. demands, 40%, 2 million in international markets. And you go back to the late 60s, when only about 5% of the bourbon that was being produced in Kentucky was being shipped overseas, we had about 9 million barrels in inventory versus 3 million now. So we've got three times, and we'll catch up about where we're relative to what's in the U.S. And so it's going to be sustained for years to come. I think it started when the distilleries, we didn't really change anything we were doing in the 80s. When we started focusing on premium bourbon brands, like single barrel bourbons, small batch bourbons. Blanton's was the first, what was that, 82 or 83, somewhere around there. And then the Jim Beam series, small batch series in 87, around that time. Booker, of course, Booker Noe, the famous master distiller, Basil Hayden, helped me, Knob Creek, and then what am I missing?
Bakers,
right. Those four, and then everybody started chiming in, doing the same thing, focusing on, you know, this is how good we are, and that's how we got the message out. And so that slowed the decline that we've been having for 20 years, began to level off, and by the end of the 90s, we began to grow, and then this century so far, the last 15 years has just been phenomenal. It keeps growing. And a lot of it is started, I think, and it's continued because people have begun to see around the world that we are a premium whiskey, and there is another whiskey in this world besides Scotch, and it's Kentucky bourbon. And so we've got a long, long, long way to go. And so we're just beginning. This right. growth, really believe that's going to be sustained for years and years and years to come, because people finally began to realize how good and versatile bourbon is. And I mean, skies are ceiling, and
right.
it's going to keep going.
Well, so let's talk about maybe some of the experiences you had, right? I guess so. You've traveled a lot when you were at Seagram's. You are now, I guess, any massive distiller is almost considered like an international celebrity, right? So you travel the world, you kind of see these things. Do you have any kind of stories or experiences of like the best place you visited or anything like that?
I hate sitting on a plane, but I love when I get someplace. I always love it, and whether it be somewhere in Europe, I love going to London. It's a beautiful city, and I actually walk off a plane, and I feel like, you know, I'm home again.
You feel like Heathrow's home every time I'm there.
Not Heathrow. Once I get to a hotel and start meeting the people I know and going around visiting, they wear me out. Go to bars. Have events all day, talking with groups of people, and then bars as long as I can stay awake at night, and then get up the next morning and do it all over again. But it's fun.
Yeah.
And I enjoy the people, but whether it be the UK, you know, London, England, or Glasgow, Scotland, we'll be in France, traveling all around France, or Spain, and Germany, Austria, or Japan. I mean, every time you get somewhere, people are always, I love talking with the people, and people are always so gracious, and it's enjoyable. I can't say I have a favorite place. I love everywhere I visit, and every time I go somewhere, it's a new experience and an enjoyable experience.
Well, good. Well, let's talk about the bourbon itself, right? We'll talk about your child here, your baby that you nurse and love to talk about so much. So I guess give us some kind of talking points about. Let's talk about your super premium releases, right? Your small batch limited releases, your single barrel releases, which 2014 was the last of the single barrel limited. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say it's the last.
Okay.
We have been doing it. These whole series started. Let's see. I think it was September 2006. My 40th anniversary in the business, and we've always had releases or introduction of something new, generally in September. We especially started that when we weren't really in the U.S., just starting back, because that's the month of the Kentucky Bourbon Festival, which has become over years an international event, and so we could get a little exposure outside the U.S. But we, our CEO back then came to me and asked me, Jim, on your 40th anniversary, if we had a special bottling of some kind for you, what would you like to do? And I told him, I said, well, if you're serious, I'd like to have a single barrel selection. I'll pick the, select the recipe we use, the barrels we use for this, and we'll dump the barrels and bottle them. Of course, if we dump and bottle them, it's going to have charcoal in it. But I was already immediately thinking way ahead. I don't want to chill filter anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gave me some negotiating room. One of the quality manager back then from with Kieran and Tokyo, from Tokyo, oh, he was dead set against that. And we had some go around. I said, all right, we just won't do anything. And the
yeah.
CEO said, we'll do that. And we'll have a single barrel. You select the barrels. We won't chill filter, but we will have to take the charcoal out. So that's what we've always done since that time, is any of our limited editions is running through a sock type filter only to remove the charcoal, and gives consumers as close as they can come, unless they have an opportunity to visit a distillery, stick a thief in a barrel and taste something straight from the barrel. Because all we're going to do is take the charcoal out. So that started the whole limited edition series. That was in 2006. 2008, we started the first, what we call now, limited edition small batch.
It was the Mirage back then.
Mirage. Yeah, it was. That's one of the reasons we changed the name.
Yeah.
Is that most people got it wrong. In fact, we had our CEO asked me to write a press release for the release of Mirage. And he wanted to read it first, and I'm glad he did, because I was writing Mirage like it's not really there.
You need one of those things that when you look in, like, the encyclopedia or Wikipedia, it has, like, how to actually say it, you know, like, on the label or
the
something.
The pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah. But it makes sense to change the label.
Well, it, you know, most people call it marriage, because Mirage was the French spelling of marriage without one of the R's. A lot of people call it Meritage, like a wine. And then, but my favorite was Mirage, like it's not really there.
It's like,
so we had a 2008 solid. And 2009 Mirage, and then we changed it to what it was then. We just changed and started calling it what it is, a limited edition small batch. So that changed with our 2010 limited edition small batch, which was one of my favorite all time, that and the 2013 limited edition small batch.
So what goes into the process of selecting something that's just going to be a regular small batch versus something that's going to be one of the limited editions, right? Is there something that's discernible, or is it higher age statements? Is it just your palate that chooses it?
One of the reasons, with our 10 recipes, we're very unique in that. That was started back in the Seagram years in the late 40s. Consistency is in our industry, from bottling run, is totally impossible to be achieved. Every barrel's different. Every barrel's going to have its own fingerprint of flavor. So if whether you're going to dump 10 barrels or 100 or 1,000, if you're dumping 100 barrels for a bottling run, if you got 100 variables, how are you going to be able to make it taste exactly like it did the previous bottling? And the answer is you don't. There's always going to be. But that's part of the art of the industry. But because of that, Seagram's R&D philosophy was, if we have 10 unique flavors of bourbon with one target flavor profile, that's all we had back in those years, was our regular Four Roses bourbon. We call it Yellow Label now for obvious reasons. If we have 10 sample barrels that we're going to dump for a bottling run, prior to bottling run, tweak that form a little more one, less one, other here or there, maybe even not have to use water more of the recipes, or maybe adjust some ages. But we can consistently hit that target flavor profile. Now, we still use that same philosophy for a yellow label, and it still can't be achieved. Now, maybe it's the most consistent on the market in consistency, but to me, that doesn't really mean anything because that is part of the art of the industry. The real bonuses behind that, to me, were achieved when, in the 80s, when the industry began to, focus on, again, the premiums. And everything we do is different by formula design of our 10 Kentucky straight bourbon whiskeys that we distill separately, age separately. So we use four of those recipes consistently for our regular small batch. Now, the Mariage, the first 2 years, 2008 and 2009, we would only use two because of the theory, Mariage, we would use two recipes, and the idea behind it, you can add one plus one and get zero, like in a marriage or one or right. two, but the idea is one plus one is something special, four or five, and you just got to experiment and work with it and try to blend something, and where the sum is greater than the two components. And that was the idea behind the Mariage. So to... Then when we changed it to limited edition small batch in 2010, that opened it up to it could still be two or three or four or five. You get beyond that, and you're going to be beating your head in the wall because four or five, there's so many various combinations you can make.
It's about the same.
It's endless. The limited editions, we want them to be older, a little bit older. Now, we don't put barrels away. We won't never have done it. We won't do it. We will not fill a barrel today and say we're going to age this 12 or 13 or 15 or 20 years because too often what's in the barrel when it becomes old gets too woody and harsh and it takes on too many tannins. You just don't know when that's going to happen. So the barrels, we put up way every year, extra barrels. And when we find barrels that are, we start survey sampling one lot of bourbon for us is eight of our fermenters. It's going to be about 285 barrels we barrel every day, Monday through Friday. And when we find something that's maturing slowly, getting better with age, we'll put a hold on it. Do not use for anything. That's the ones that become older age. They earn their way into these extra years of age. And that's what we try to use, whether it be a limited edition single barrel or a limited edition small batch. And so it's they're older. Then we start looking at evaluating lots, and we might decide, we want to use four this time or two. This year it's coming up. It's going to be a very good year, I think, in 2015. We use three of our recipes. And but it's an art. You never know, because you can take this really good barrel of bourbon, mix it with another really good barrel of bourbon, put them together, it's not so good.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take... this barrel's okay, put them together, and wow, it's something outstanding. You don't know until you try. It's just trial and error, experimenting. It's a lot of fun. There's art involved. But that's our limited edition small batch.
So you would think that's the level of innovation that Four Roses goes at, right, to try to figure out with these 10 different recipes that you're trying to mix and match and these different flavor profiles to – maybe release something that is special, right? Instead of trying to say, like, oh, we're going to go and source wood from Bulgaria or whatever it is, right? Maybe you're just trying to just experiment that way.
Yeah, no, we're not interested in, you can source wood, two different trees in Missouri, that could be the same either.
Right.
And you don't know what you're going to get. And the difference, I think, would be pretty minimal. There's so many experiments going on and doing things different and just trying as an industry. We could sit on our, we the industry could sit on our laurels and go back years and years and years. But one of the things we do, and we're all friends, you get down to the distillers and the production end of the business, we are very close, and we'll do anything in the world to help each other out. We're all doing, we're doing the same thing, but we're doing it differently. And we all try to help each other out, but none of us are ever satisfied. We're here today. Four Roses has been around a lot longer. I've been around a long time. Some people around here occasionally ask me, well, you know, what was Paul Jones Jr. like? He died in 1894. So that's not much of a compliment. But, you know, we've been around a long time, and we carry on the tradition. But people ask me, you know, we don't want to mess anything up, for number one. But I'll tell you right now, I came here in 94. If we're not better today than we were in 2002 or 1994 or 4 or 5 years ago, somebody else ought to be doing it. You're never satisfied. Always doing something better, getting better with time. That's just the way of life, and that's the way it is. And we're all doing that. So,
no, it makes sense. That makes sense. So I guess going back to the single barrels, you know, one of the things that I really love about Four Roses is that it I don't know, maybe it sounds cheesy or whatever, but it's the whole process of when you go and you pick up a bottle and you can see the proof, you can see what warehouse it came from, you can see all these different things that actually go on handwritten labels. It's almost like a box of chocolates, right? You kind of never know what you're going to get because they're all, as you said, they're all unique in their own special way. Now, do you think that's a special characteristic that what makes Four Roses so unique in being able to provide a bourbon like that?
Oh, absolutely. With the 10 recipes that we age, and then, of course, you know, let's just take one of our recipes. We have letters, OBSV, OESK, OESF, or OBSQ, of those OBs. The second letter will be a mash bill, be either a B or an E. Then the fourth letter is going to be a V, K, O, Q, or F, and that's just our designation for our five proprietary yeast strains. And you know, you can take a 2006 OBSV is going to be a lot different than 2007 or 7 year or 8 or 9 or 10 years old. They're, everything's going to be different. You start combining just three recipes, and but you might throw a couple years in each for that. And I mean, we could spend a year trying to come up with a perfect blend and the perfect bourbon. You're never going to achieve it, but
that's
you keep trying.
Yeah, it never
and,
stops.
That's right. But the variables is so unique because we have those variables to work with, and it's more than 10 really, because every day it's in a barrel that's different. You know, 6 year old is going to be dramatically different than a 12 year old, a 15 year old is going to be a heck of a lot different. So the choices are, I'd say, infinite.
Right.
That we start off with. So it's, you know, we try to pick when we're making, we're looking at a limited edition small batch. And I had a hard time last year proving something. I don't know how many rejects I went through, but it's probably 100. I don't know. This year was really easy. I mean, you hit it, and you might do it. This year, the first time I sat out and looked about 10, 12 samples, something like that, and I saw 3 or 4 of them that were really, really good, and then narrowing it down to which one of these are the best.
Now, is this for the 2014 or for the 2015 2B?
2015.
Oh, good.
No, I had trouble with the 2014. And But this year was, I think it's going to be a really special bourbon.
Good. Cool.
And I'm looking forward to it. Now, see, we've already selected now. So we selected this in end of January. Now, the downside of that is, When we're putting something together, we're working in a lab with graduated cylinders. We've got, you know, if it's, just make it simple, if it's 4 and we've got 25%, 25, 25, 25, that's easy. We can get them all precise. But you go to dump those barrels, and those two barrels, you know, we can calculate what should be in the barrel.
Whatever the angels took away, right?
It might be 24, yeah. Some might be 26. So it's not as easy as it sounds. You've got to get the percentage. Now, we work hard to make sure those percentages are, and our quality manager does a great job. Now, I'm making sure those percents are very, very close. Then, you know, we were talking about older bourbon just a minute ago. And one of the reasons we never fill a barrel to become 12, 15, 20 years old is because the sweet flavors of bourbon are generated from the natural sugars of that white oak when those sugars are dissipated, you better use that bourbon pretty quick, because what's left in the barrel then is going to pick up too many tannins, take on the harshness, the character of the wood itself. You never know when it's going to happen. And just selecting these, but right now in January we made this selection, approved the recipe we use. Now this bourbon's going to have to be in a barrel another 7 months. So something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so you never know. It could get better in 7 months.
Yeah, no, Kentucky weather, you never know, too.
Or it could get worse. We don't know. And if it did, we'd have to change things at the very end, use the same recipes because it's on the bottle.
Right.
But it wouldn't be the same. So we've got another 7 months to worry that we can consistently put in a bottle what we hope to today.
Yeah.
Is that with your warehouses, they're typically one story about six high, I think. Yeah. Is that why you do that, to kind of remove some of the variables of having a larger warehouse?
It is, exactly. Okay. And those were built by Seagram in 1960. But we had five operating distilleries back then. When I started in 66, we still had five operating distilleries in Kentucky. Each one of those distillery sites had their own multi-story warehouses. The warehouses on the other side of the road here, when you come in, they used to belong to Seagram's distillery right here. They were sold to another distillery in 1976. But we had the five operating distilleries, and then we built those like the hub of a wheel. Those, it's actually in Lotus, Kentucky, but the post office is in Nelson County, Cox's Creek, so we call it, say, Cox's Creek. But as we close the distilleries, we just have this distillery now, and we're 50 miles from our warehouse facility, but that's the reason. But we built those to store the barrels that the Seagram distilleries were producing that were going to be targeted for bourbon and not blended whiskeys. And to achieve consistency, we had all the variables we needed with 10 mm-hmm. recipes. So now in a multi-story warehouse, you can get a 35 plus or minus temperature differential from bottom floor to top floor, especially in the hot months, where we've reduced that. We do rack our barrels six tiers high versus the traditional three tiers high in multi-story. And we get a temperature differential from the bottom tier to the sixth tier of about 6 degrees, maybe on extremes, 8 degrees, but usually average around 6 degrees. Even that small temperature differential makes a difference. There's still variables. They're not as dramatic. But the barrels that we fill on the top tier, they will always increase in strength during the maturation process. The fifth tier will increase, but not as much as the sixth tier. The bottom tier always loses strength, as does the second, but not as much. So the cooler you get, the more strength, alcohol strength you do lose during the aging process. The fourth tier generally is right around our entry proof. Third, second, first tiers lose proof. Fifth and sixth tiers gain strength. So you still, even with a 6 degree temperature differential, you still get variables, but it's not as dramatic as if it had 35 degrees.
When I was a kid in high school, I worked for a landscaping, but my job was to weed eat around Heaven Hills warehouses, and you would go by the windows on the bottom floor and cold air would rush out, and I'm like, how's that possible? It's 100 degrees outside, but I guess upstairs it's probably 110, you know. And
well, it would be warmer, but you stop and think, it's, I know when I lived in New York, we go to the beach sometimes, so it's in July. And it might be hot outside, but you get that water. Wow, it's cold. It was bone-chilling cold, even in July, because such a huge body of liquid. It's been hot outside, but it takes time. So you got this big warehouse of all these barrels, you know, several thousand barrels in a warehouse full of liquid. And they've been cold, really, really, really cold through the winter, like they are right now. Gets in the summer. And it takes a long time to cool, so it's like you're in an air-conditioned building. Conversely, because they warm up in the summer, you go in one in the winter, it's cold, but it's not as cold as it is outside.
Right.
It just takes a while for this liquid to adjust, but that's a part of the reason why Kentucky is so perfect. Everybody talks about limestone water as the reason bourbon made here is so good, but it's also our climate and our geographic location in that. You know, we have about as many hot days as cold days during the course of a year, and that's perfect for the maturation process.
Yeah, it's very dramatic here. I think 2 weeks ago it was like 50 degrees and we were golfing. Now there's 12 inches of snow on the ground.
Yeah, 10 or 15 below. Last Friday morning I came in here driving in. I know Lloyd was talking about a 7 below. And yeah. I hit one time in the Bluegrass Parkway, minus 26, and several people got it. And I had it on my phone, my car. When I pulled in the parking lot Friday morning, it was 23 below zero. Now, it warmed up that day quite a bit. She would have got up to 15 degrees by noon. It got warmer during the day, but that felt like a heat wave.
Yeah, exactly. Just these rapid fluctuations. So I guess one last question before we wrap it up. You know, with these 10 different recipes, one might think to wonder, you know, with a bunch of brand expansions and people that are, throwing up micro distilleries and sourcing barrels or whatever, like, why wouldn't you just say, like, well, I could create 10 different brands out of these 10 different recipes?
And we could. We could do 100 or 1,000, but whatever. Now, when we first came back to the U.S., I mean, we've been gone a long time. We've been the number one selling bourbon, as we talked a long time ago, 30s, 40s, 50s, but we went away. The blended whiskey really destroyed our name. And all the debates I had through the years with Seagram, I didn't disagree with him. I just, in one respect, but that didn't make any difference. I still wanted to bring our bourbon back home. And I used to argue, all we have to do is find a way to get people to try our bourbon. They never would agree, but that's why we started the single barrel. Some people wanted to just make the yellow label bourbon go away. I said, I don't think we ought to do that. Let's just let it sit. We won't put any money behind it, but we'll see what happened. Now it's our number one seller of what we have. So we introduced our single barrel in September 2004, our small batch in September 2006. That and the yellow label, those three, so we have three. They're all very, very different flavor profiles. And I know going back even 3, 4, 5 years ago, people started saying, we need to put something else in the market. And so people are beginning to understand. But, you know, it was 2007, I guess, when we first moved. When we started back, we had the barrel inventory for Kentucky. Then 2007, we began to move out into a few other states. And then... couple of years after, people said, boy, we need to come up with something new and different, exciting. But to most of the people in the U.S., they'd never heard of us. We're just getting this message out. And I felt like we need to focus on who we are, what we have, before we can put out something different. And it lessens our focus on our core brands. And we're going to diversify, and we're going to market this, but what's going to happen right now, we need to focus on our name, reestablishing our name as a quality bourbon, not some blended whiskey. And that's why we haven't done. We could come up with any number, and we will eventually. But we had to get established and let not just people in Kentucky, but California, New York, and Texas, and Maine know that we're quality straight Kentucky bourbon, and that's why we haven't done that.
Well, fantastic. Well, Jim, we want to thank you very much for your time today. This has been a pleasure. We've definitely gone long. We're probably going to break this into two episodes, but if you like what you're hearing, make sure you subscribe to us at Bourbon Pursuit on the podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter, also at Bourbon Pursuit.
Yeah, and any comments, feedback, show suggestions, appreciate it. Hope you guys enjoy, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.